Involvement with the criminal justice system is life-changing. It matters.
Having a justice system that works is a really important part of a democratic society.
I'm Penelope Gibbs, Director of Transform Justice.
I'm Rob Allen. I've worked in and around criminal justice all my career.
This is the Transform Justice podcast, throwing light on the criminal justice system.
Hearing from people who know.
It's about whether the system's fair.
And what can be done to make it better.
Hello. Today we're going to tackle a critical issue in justice, how to deal with wrongful convictions. Here to discuss the system in England and Wales is my co-host Rob Allen, Dr. John Robbins, a freelance journalist, and Matt Foote, who has just started as co-director of the charity Appeal. Rob, we did a podcast about the post office scandal. What were your reflections about that?
Well, first of all, it was quite shocking to me that several hundred sub-postmasters and mistresses had been wrongly convicted, many sent to prison. But it got me thinking, you know, how widespread is the problem of wrongful convictions and how good are our systems for uncovering those instances and putting them right?
John, the case of Andrew Malkinson seems to have captured the public imagination in a new way. Can you outline for people who don't know about that case what happened in that case?
Well, perhaps first of all, I can just say it's really unusual for a miscarriage of justice case to kind of capture the imagination of the media. And I can't really think of an equivalent case that's looked at kind of the systemic issues. So this is kind of a rare moment. He was convicted of rape and he spent 17 years in prison and he spent 20 years trying to clear his name and had his conviction overturned at the beginning of the summer.
This is after he's come out of prison?
After he's come out of prison, yeah. So he served 17 years in prison.
And he still was just so traumatised by having this conviction over him that he still wanted to go through the process even after getting out of prison.
Yeah, so he made an application to the Criminal Cases Review Commission, which is the miscarriage of justice watchdog, I think back in 2005. Matt, am I right on that?
I mean, certainly in 2012 and 2020, which are the important dates, because there was no DNA to connect Andrew Malkinson to the victim. But they found in 2007 DNA belonging to somebody else in a significant area on her top. And in 2009, the CCRC knew about that DNA, but refused to do anything. And so one of the big questions is, why is the body that is invested in looking at miscarriages of justice refusing to carry out that sort of inquiry that would or could have saved Andrew Malkinson something like 10 years in prison?
Matt, why do you think this case has ignited so much interest, perhaps unlike others that have happened before? Is it because of the weaknesses of the CCRC or other reasons?
I think there are a number of factors, but one of them is that Andrew Malkinson is very eloquent about what's happened to him. And the speech he made outside of court was incredibly moving because he even talked about that he wasn't the only victim here, but the victim of the rape has been let down because the true assailant has not been prosecuted. And so I think there's a human side to it, but it also, it's an extraordinary case because it does highlight weaknesses across the system. So following the conviction, Greater Manchester Police have apologised to Andrew Malkinson. The Crown Prosecution Service have apologised. So they both accepted as bodies that they were at fault in the history of this, in refusing to disclose material. And then we have this extraordinary situation where the CCRC, who are, in my view, even more at fault, are refusing to apologise despite 150,000 people signing a petition calling on them to do so. All these failures together have highlighted all the things that are going wrong in the system, and I think people have really picked up on that and understood the detail, which is so refreshing.
Yeah, I mean, John, it does sound like it illustrates a lot that went wrong at various stages. I mean, one aspect I think is that Andrew Malkinson stayed in prison quite a lot longer than he would have had he admitted the offence for which he was wrongfully convicted. How did that come about?
Well, I'm reminded of a very similar case, which is the Victor Neyland case. And Victor Neyland spent 17 years in prison before having his conviction overturned on the basis of production of DNA. He spent an extra decade in prison because he protested his innocence. And if you protest your innocence, you don't go through the parole system, you don't demonstrate your rehabilitation. And rather like Malkinson, right from the start, Victor Neyland was saying, I'm innocent. And he was calling upon the police, the prosecution, and the Criminal Cases Review Commission to actually do DNA testing. And it was a DNA testing that eventually got his conviction overturned. So he got stuck in the system because that is what happens if you protest your innocence.
Well, the system can't cope with people who say that they didn't do it. And so somehow they're just felt to be in denial of some offence of which they were accused.
Yeah, the system isn't built to cope with that.
Matt, Andrew Malkinson's case, his only recourse was to take his case to the CCRC, and you've touched on what went wrong there. Can you explain what the CCRC is supposed to do and what it did or didn't do in Andrew Malkinson's case?
So the Criminal Cases Review Commission is the only body that can refer a case to the Court of Appeal if you've already had an appeal that's failed.
So you're accused of a crime, you're prosecuted, you plead not guilty, but you are convicted. You then say to your lawyer, I didn't do it, let's appeal this, and you lose. Then this is another place you go to after you've already lost in the court.
That's right. If you've had an appeal and you've lost, it's the only way you can get back to the Court of Appeal is if the Criminal Cases Review Commission refer it. I mean, Andrew Malkinson is a stark example. And when he came out of prison with a T-shirt and said, innocent, but I'm not the only one, that there are many people in this position who can't get their cases back to the Court of Appeal because the Criminal Cases Review Commission has become moribund and is not referring enough cases.
So if you could give an example of what happens, you know, say Eddie Guilfoyle has been taken to the CCRC and what the CCRC say about not taking it forward anymore.
Well, in the case of Eddie Guilfoyle, which I worked on for far too long, about 17 years, this was a man who was convicted of murdering his wife. His wife was 8.5 months pregnant and she was found hanging. And the issue in the case was it murder or was it suicide? There was no signs of struggle, no bruising or anything. There was no forensic evidence to support murder at all. The case, in my view, was built upon myths that she couldn't put the rope over the beam herself and upon the idea that she was happy because she was pregnant. And back in 1993, nobody knew anything about antenatal depression. In terms of what's turned up since, that when I went to Birmingham Police Station in 2012, I discovered 2 5-year diaries, 10 years of her life, which revealed that as a 13-year-old, she was with a man who was 5 years older. And a few years after being with him, she split up with him. And 3 days later, he went and had sex with a stranger in the park and murdered them. Now, that fact was just about known about at trial, but what wasn't known was her continuing infatuation with that man and the fact that she had a previous suicide attempt. The CCRC's response to that is that this is normal adolescent behaviour. It's staggering that they cannot see that that would be relevant to a jury. And the idea that she could be presented as happy and uncomplicated is just complete nonsense. The question really is, why has the CCRC become like this? Because the CCRC themselves referred Eddie's case as one of the first cases when they set up, and they truly believed it was a terrible miscarriage of justice, and then they no longer believed. And what had happened in the meantime is that the organisation had changed. They don't go and see the scene, they don't go and see the appellant, they don't go and see the witnesses. They're all working remotely. Then you can't solve miscarriage of justice sitting at home on your own, looking at documents and deferring to the Court of Appeal judgment. You have to get out there and go and discover the truth. And there were all sorts of things that we gave them which were never considered properly or investigated or whatever. There's no accountability for the CCRC. If they make a decision like that, there's not really anything you can do apart from judicial review. And so we need a tribunal who can look at it afresh.
Can I just ask, because it's in my mind, Eddie Guilfoyle was referred to the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal presumably wouldn't overturn it.
Yes.
So why, if they refuse to overturn it then, why would they make a different decision at another point?
If we took that view, that there's nothing more we can do, then the Birmingham Six would still be in prison, the Guildford Four, the Bridgewater Four. All these cases took more than two appeals. So we can't defer to the court in that way. We have to challenge them. And behind every big miscarriage of justice is a terrible Court of Appeal judgment. So you have to keep going. And what you need at the CCRC are people who understand that and are brave and prepared to keep going. The case of Cooper and McMahon took five times to get back to the Court of Appeal. There's no chance in hell that you would get a Cooper and McMahon today.
John, so in the case of the Birmingham Six, what was that miscarriage of justice?
So the Birmingham Six were six innocent Irish men who were wrongly convicted, being behind the pub bombings in Birmingham, which took place in the 1970s. And they had confessions beaten out of them by the police, and evidence was kind of framed. And on that basis, they spent 16 years in prison before having their convictions overturned. I mean, the case has this huge kind of significance because it led to public outcry, a royal commission. The royal commission led to the creation of this miscarriage of justice watchdog. Matt made a point that I think is really important, and I wanted to kind of emphasise. Every year, we see about 1,500 people writing to the Criminal Cases Review Commission. Typically, over its first year, the commission was sending back 33 cases every year to the Court of Appeal. So not a massively high kind of hit rate. In 2016, those numbers completely collapsed to just a dozen. And these numbers have not recovered. But also, the Court of Appeal typically was rejecting 3 out of 10 of those referrals. So if by some miracle you're that innocent person, wrongly convicted, you're in prison, you write to Birmingham, the chances of getting your case sent back to the Court of Appeal are minuscule and then halved because the Court of Appeal probably is going to kick your case out. Now, only two cases have been sent back a second time to the Court of Appeal for them to take another look at it. One is a case called Tony Stock. When we talk about these miscarriages of justice, they're always complicated. They're always in the grey area. But Tony Stock is a case, I'd argue, it absolutely is black and white. It's kind of an armed robbery, took place in 1970. One of the gang who did the armed robbery turned supergrass in 1979. And in 1996, the supergrass, the armed robber, went to the Court of Appeal and he said, I did the robbery. No idea who this guy Tony Stock is. And still, the Court of Appeal didn't overturn his conviction. I mean, Matt's father, Paul Foote, in 1996, wrote an absolutely scathing article for Private Eye called Judge Dreadful about how the Court of Appeal made a mistake, failed to recognise an obvious, a blindingly obvious injustice. There's something about the Malkinson case which really usefully shines a light on the Criminal Cases Review Commission, but we must also remember behind the commission, there is the Court of Appeal as well, and we need to focus on why the Court of Appeal fails to get to grips with some of these really difficult cases. To a certain extent, the commission has kind of become a scapegoat, if you like, for bigger problems within the system.
Does there need to be new evidence for them to reach a different decision? Is that, in effect, what's needed for them to overturn a case? Or
there either needs to be new evidence or new legal arguments. There has to be something new.
Yeah, the problem with the way that works, Rob, is that it becomes like a salami slice thing where points that have been taken to the Court of Appeal are sort of set aside as they just focus on the smaller and smaller point that you can find that's fresh. They don't take a holistic view of the case. And in my view, if you take a holistic view of Eddie Guilfoyle, there's very little left in the case that you could properly put to a jury because you have to focus on some new thing that you have to find, which is increasingly difficult to do because people don't leave good points behind when they go to appeal. It can become harder and harder. unless the pressure from outside and the campaign opens up the court to the outside world so that everybody's looking at the issue.
In the Stock case, the farcical situation was that you had the Supergrass who came before the court in 1996, who said, "I did the job, no idea who Tony Stock was." The Court of Appeal misunderstood his evidence. And when it came back to the Court of Appeal in 2004, the Court of Appeal said, "No, we're not going to let the Supergrass in because we've considered it before."
But if I get convicted and it's because I haven't had a very good legal team with me, or the jury decision kind of flies in the face of the evidence and contrasts with the judge's summing up, is that enough to get an appeal or go to the CCRC, or do you actually need to find a diary or DNA or something like that?
The hardest point to take is any failing in the defence team. It's a very high threshold to run that as a ground, and that's why it's generally hardly ever run. And it's a terrible thing that the legal system tends to protect its own. You know, any barristers that may have mucked up can't possibly be criticised unless it's absolutely clear. I mean, Eddie Guilfoyle, a few years after he was convicted, finds he's sharing the same wing as his solicitor, who was convicted for fraud. But that isn't a point that you can run at the Court of Appeal.
You seriously? You're telling me that despite the fact that his solicitor was convicted of fraud to such an extent that he got a prison sentence, that can't be used in any appeal?
It's not a point that goes towards the evidence that was against him.
On the Omar Benguit case, I think about three of Omar's previous lawyers have done time in prison. Just as an aside, one of them was the lawyer known as the devil's advocate. I don't know if people are familiar with it. It does happen.
John, talking about this kind of straitjacket, that there's this very narrow criteria for taking cases to the CCRC and then back to the Court of Appeal, does that mean that a historic sex abuse case where one person says they were wrongly convicted because it didn't happen, but it's one person's word against another, that has no chance of getting looked at?
I think that's going to be very, very difficult. You know, what lawyers will talk about is the real possibility test. And the idea is that Criminal Cases Review Commission is obligated to second guess the Court of Appeal. So that it has to go through the thought processes of the appeal judges and take the view, if there is a real possibility that the appeal judges might overturn this case, then we can refer it back. So you get an increasingly conservative Court of Appeal, then by definition, it's going to refer less cases, which is what we've seen happen. On the particular example of kind of historic sex cases, it's by far the most numerous in terms of the applications that go to the Criminal Cases Review Commission. So they are a real concern.
So what we're talking about is the Criminal Cases Review Commission is supposed not to refer a case to the Court of Appeal unless they think it's got a very high likelihood of succeeding.
If there's a real possibility that the Court of Appeal would find the conviction unsafe, they're supposed to refer it, yeah? So what does real possibility mean? They've been warned several times by official reviews to err on the side of the appellant, but they haven't. So we had the Justice Select Committee in 2015. We had a triennial review of the CCRC. And then we had the all-party parliamentary group commission into the CCRC. All of them said the same thing. Please refer more cases because it's too low. And they've ignored all three of those warnings. So, I mean, the test has to change. Everybody agrees now the predictive test of what would the Court of Appeal think is no good because it's too conservative. But the problem is that the CCRC has to change as well because it's not listening to the warnings. There's a real cultural problem that if you haven't got people invested in this who really come from a tradition of fighting injustices, you've got no chance whatsoever.
But John, wouldn't the CCRC say, well, okay, we don't send many cases, but of the ones we do send, 70% are successful, and that's a pretty good rate?
Well, there's an argument to be made that for that 70% figure to be far lower, and they should be kind of pushing at the boundaries to force the Court of Appeal to get to grips with the difficult cases rather than the Court of Appeal setting, what the kind of threshold should be. So you get this bizarre system where you get these shocking miscarriages of justice. They set up what we call a watchdog, and then we criticise the watchdog for being overly deferential to the courts. When the commission was originally set up, people were calling for these cases to be taken out of the courts. Justice, the human rights group, for example, led by, you know, Tom Sargent, who was a huge character. He wanted what he called a kind of a determinative body that could make decisions on these cases without reference to the courts. And, you know, there's a lot of sense in that. I think it's an idea that lawyers find unpalatable. But actually, if the problem is in the courts, it's unlikely the courts are going to be able to solve it, if you like.
So the idea there was more a kind of inquisitorial committee which took a case and was not dominated by judges and so on, and didn't use the sort of adversarial system to decide ultimately whether these cases were wrongful convictions or not. We're a million miles from that, aren't we?
Well, we are a million miles from that, but we also have a Law Commission review looking at the criminal appeals system. So how radical are its proposals going to be? You know, what's on the table?
Mm. It sounds like you both think that more cases could be and should be overturned. When cases are overturned, like the Andrew Malcolmson one, do people automatically get some kind of compensation for the time that they have spent imprisoned, you know, improperly, as it were? Or is that not a kind of automatic right for people?
There's a terrible, brutal compensation scheme now in this country, and it became brutal in 2014. So in order to get compensation, the new fact on which your conviction has been quashed needs to show that you're innocent beyond all reasonable doubt. And that's an extremely difficult hurdle to meet. And so now virtually nobody is getting compensation. I think there were something like 350 applications from 2017 to 2022, and less than 4% of those applications receive compensation.
Who makes that decision?
There's an independent assessor, which I think is done under the auspices of the Ministry of Justice.
But the initial decision goes to the minister. There is something of a conflict there. I mean, I represented Sam Hallam, who came out of Court of Appeal in 2012, and he's had to fight ever since, not only to get to the Court of Appeal and get his conviction overturned for a murder, which he, in my view, had nothing to do with. 14 witnesses said he wasn't there. 14, including the intended victim of the crime, said, "I know Sam Hallam," and he wasn't there. But since 2012, he's not only had to get through that, he's had to fight for the compensation. So his case is at the European Court of Human Rights as we speak, and we're waiting for judgment from them. But it is quite a scandal that he should be looked after, this young man. He should be getting therapeutic care, not having to go through another misery of, you know, he spent nearly 7 years in prison. And while he was in prison, his dad committed suicide. Obviously, he couldn't cope with the whole thing. I mean, it's just appalling.
The sort of depressing thing about that is it sort of puts a cloud over, doesn't it, a wrongful conviction being overturned if a judgment is made that, as it were, the person isn't innocent?
Yes, that's exactly what it does. It's saying you're not really innocent, even if you've had your conviction quashed. And what we should have been doing with the Sam Hallam case is investigating why the hell this case happened. There were all sorts of failures that should have been the focus, not we're not going to pay you any money. We should have been correcting the system so this doesn't happen again.
Sam Hallam's case is being heard in Strasbourg with another case called Victor Neelam, which I mentioned before, where they are challenging the refusal by the Ministry of Justice to compensate them. So I mentioned Victor's case before. He was in prison for 17 years. When he was released from prison, he left with a £46 cheque and a bin bag full of his possessions. And he was going to meet his friend at the Royal Courts of Justice, but the hearing happened by video link. So he was in Shrewsbury. And he would have spent his first night sleeping on the streets after 17 years in prison were it not for a couple of BBC journalists. And he ended up selling his story and they put him up in a B&B. And this is the way we treat wrongly convicted people. It is scandalous. I mentioned before, you get every year 1,500 people write to Birmingham saying, "Look at my case, I'm innocent." Typically, about 19 might get referred back to the Court of Appeal. half of those might not get their convictions overturned. So if by some absolute miracle you're one of those people who make it through that, you're almost definitely not going to get any support from the state for essentially being a victim of, you know, a state error. The previous government, Labour, kind of cut a far more generous discretionary scheme. So in the last 3 years, the Ministry of Justice has paid out 1.42 million. Compared to 3 years in 1999 to 2001, the government paid out £42 million for similar numbers. You know, what we're talking is outrageous and it's important.
One of you mentioned that the Law Commissioner conducting some kind of consultation on changes to the appeal system as a whole, I think. Are you optimistic? Is there a kind of consensus around some of the things you've been telling us, that the system's effectively broken and needs to be fixed? Matt, what do you think?
I'm mildly optimistic, actually. I think the Law Commission seemed to understand the issues from the consultation document that's come out. There are lots of inquiries into the Malkinson case, but it's the understanding of the general nature of these problems that really is crucial, because we can talk about them, but if we have mild reform, little reform, it won't do anything. There really does need to be an overhaul of the CCRC, and there needs to be a changing of the test, there needs to be accountability, and we need to keep referring cases back to put pressure on the Court of Appeal, because at the moment, too many innocent people are not getting justice.
John, the Law Commission only looks at issues if they've been asked to by the government. Does this work on the appeal system indicate to you that the government has got a view that things are going wrong?
Well, it's interesting because this is the second time there's been a call for a Law Commission review. It happened after the Justice Committee made a report on the CCRC in 2015, and it was rejected by Michael Gove, who was then the Justice Secretary, on the kind of assurance from the former Lord Chief Justice, Lord Judge, that everything was kind of tickety-boo and there's nothing to look at. So like Matt, I think I'm kind of very mildly optimistic, despite the history in this area, that actually there is some kind of determination. And I think the Andrew Malkinson case has been really helpful in this kind of respect, because it's just identified the systematic issues that are problematic. So you never know, do you? But one hopes there is some government will to get to the bottom of this.
Okay, thanks. That's a goodish note to end on. We usually finish these podcasts by asking each of our contributors to suggest one change that each of you would make if you were Lord Chancellor to try and make the appeals system work more effectively to help overturn miscarriages of justice. Matt, what would your one thing be?
Well, I would change the chair of the CCRC. You have to have someone in these positions who has a connection with dealing with injustice. The previous chair of the CCRC used to be the head of the CPS. The current chair, the CCRC, used to be the head of United Biscuits. I mean, I cannot understand how that sort of appointment ever came to be made. You need someone in that position who has a track record of having fought injustice in some form in order to take that organisation forward. And that needs to happen very soon.
Okay, John, what about you, if you could do one thing?
Yeah, the fix that I would go for is there are 11 commissioners at the Criminal Cases Review Commission, and the independence of the organisation resides in them. They used to have salaries, and now they work on one-day-a-week contracts. You cannot do justice to a case as complicated as Andy Malkinson, as complicated as Eddie Guilfoyle or Oliver Campbell, on a one-day-a-week basis. You need the approval, the backing of three commissioners to get a case back to the Court of Appeal. I'd also endorse Matt's point. The current chair of the Criminal Cases Review Commission is also chair of the Judicial Appointments Commission. For me, that's a clear conflict of interest. It should never have been allowed to have happened. And it's a bit of an indicator of the problems at the commission that it was allowed to happen. You didn't ask me for two ideas, but you've got one for free. So if you can do that as well, that'd be great.
Rob, what would you do if you were Lord Chancellor? What one change would you make?
Well, as you can tell, I'm not an expert in this field. I'm glad the Law Commission are doing a wide-ranging look at this. Is it enough? I mean, the big changes have come from royal commissions on criminal justice in the past. We were supposedly going to have a royal commission on justice, but the government shelved it. Maybe it needs something a bit bigger than the Law Commission to get to the bottom of this.
Thanks, Rob, John and Matt. And if you'd like to find out more about wrongful convictions and the appeal system in England and Wales, do look at our programme notes. And if you rate this podcast, do subscribe on whatever platform you use. Thanks and goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.
Goodbye.